Oye, all persons have the business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. This morning we're here to hear the case of Sterling T. Rice versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 061445. Who will speak for Mr. Rice? Thank you very much. And for the Secretary?
Good morning, Your Honor. Brian Tierney, appearing for Veterans Affairs, Veterans Affairs, and with me at council table is Brian Ribble.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tierney. Mr. Carpenter?
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. In this court's decision in Roebuck, this court noted that the Federal Circuit in its decisions in both Bingham and in Cook observed that the purpose of the rule of finality is to preclude repetitive and belated re-adjudication of veterans' benefits claims. This case presents to this court a systemic problem with the adjudication process of the Department of Veterans Affairs. In this case, Mr. Rice's case was initially decided. A notice of disagreement raised the issue of entitlement to an extra schedule or rating, and disagreed with the initial rating of 30% assigned. In so doing, the VA responded not with a statement of case to the notice of disagreement, but with a new decision on the additional issue of entitlement to an extra schedule or rating. That decision was decided favorably, and a notice of disagreement, however, was filed with the effective date assigned in that case. And unfortunately, the VA neglected to issue a statement of case on the initial notice of disagreement that dealt with the question of the initial rating assigned. That matter was observed by the board, but instead of deferring further consideration of the appeal and returning the matter to the regional office for the issuance of a statement of the case, the VA exceeded its jurisdiction by proceeding prematurely to make a final decision on the question of the effective date. Mr. Rice, in his original appeal to this court, in his brief, argued to the court that the decision of the board was inconsistent with the decision in Harris. This court recognized in its single-judge decision that the issues were inextricably intertwined, and in the initial decision dismissed this appeal. On a motion for reconsideration, Mr. Rice raised the question of whether or not the appropriate remedy was dismissal, or whether in fact this court did have jurisdiction. This matter is now before the court on Mr. Rice's motion for reconsideration of that single judge.
You characterized the board decision on the TDIU issue, effective date issue, as premature.
Yes, sir.
What would you have the board do when it addresses, first of all, are we dealing with one claim or two claims here?
We're dealing with one claim, Your Honor, and that is a claim for compensation. That claim for compensation was Mr. Rice's original claim seeking the maximum benefits available under law. This court in AB in 1983 created a judicial presumption that required the VA to presume that a veteran seeks the maximum benefit available under law.
So do I take it from your statement then that you view the award of, in this case, a total rating based on individual employability is just another means of obtaining another means of obtaining a higher rating.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, actually, not a higher rating, but a higher initial rating, because it really is part of the initial claim.
Part of one of the elements of a claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it is, in terms of effective date, a downstream issue, if you will. And that's part of why I referred to this as a systemic problem with the adjudication process by the VA that, frankly, requires this court's intervention to clarify for both the board and for the VA that there is a single claim in this matter, that no new claim is created when a veteran in a notice of disagreement after the initial award of benefits raises an entitlement to an extra schedule or rating. That is part and parcel of the original claim, and that's consistent with the VA regulations at 38 CFR 3.156B. In fact, excuse me, when the VA recently rewrote 3.156B, it refers specifically to pending claim. And that's precisely what we have here. When Mr. Rice presented his notice of disagreement, he brought to the VA's attention that he was unable to work due to his service-connected disability. That was new and material evidence received within the period of the appeal period at the time of actually the filing of the notice of disagreement. And therefore, any evidence that was received under 3.156B at the time of the notice of disagreement should have reverted back to the date of the original claim under 3.156B, which simply reinforces the fact that this is part of a single claim for compensation for the maximum benefit available under law.
Okay, having said that, then let me take you back to the premature decision of the board. Would you have the board not decide anything until it was prepared to decide everything?
Yes. That is clearly the only way that the purpose of the rule of finality to prevent or preclude repetitive and belated re-adjudications can be accomplished. The precise action that should have been taken was a deferral by the board. There should not have been a final decision. But there was, in fact, a final decision, which then triggered this court's jurisdiction under 7252 and under 7266, because Mr. Rice was adversely affected by that decision. He was entitled to seek review of that final decision. The appropriate remedy in this case is not dismissal, but is in fact a vacature of that premature board decision and a remand instruction by this court directing the board to defer further consideration of the effective date issue until they have considered in the first instance the appeal, which, by the way, has now been perfected by Mr. Rice, of the initial rating assigned. In this board decision, the board did remand to the VA with instructions to issue an SOC. An SOC was issued and a substantive appeal was filed in 2006. Unfortunately, we still do not have a final board decision on that issue by the board.
Could I ask you?
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to figure out the practical effect here. What is the harm to the veteran from the way things proceeded in this case? Explain to me, you know, how this harms the veteran. What happened? Well, not systemically, but in this case.
Sure. The harm to the veteran in this case is that as has occurred in this case, his rating was increased from the initial rating assigned of 30% to 70%. On
that
a scheduler basis.
That was in May, correct, of 2002?
That's correct. And the award was made of a total rating based upon unemployability from 2000.
Right, so, and that was on the same date?
That's correct.
So and he was receiving 100% different effective dates?
Total rating from 2000 forward, from 1998, he was receiving 70%.
Right.
The adverse effect to Mr. Rice is to prevent him from being able to present to the board the question of whether or not he qualified under a scheduler basis before he has to argue the effective date issue.
Why does that? I mean, he can still argue that the evidence that he submitted in order to obtain the extra schedule rating of 100% is still before the agency, correct? And so that the agency can still decide whether or not the evidence there was sufficient to, was extant in 1998 and therefore sufficient in some way to raise this scheduler rating.
But the problem becomes is then he has to come to this court and argue that he has a continuous claim in this case, and then the end result of that adjudication is to remand to consider from 1998 to 2000 as part of the initial claim, both the scheduler and the extra scheduler. And as a consequence, he ends up having to litigate a matter that he should not have to litigate. He should have one appeal, one decision by the secretary, made by the board, of all of the elements of his claim. From 1998 to 2000 on a scheduler basis, from 1998 to 2000 on an extra scheduler basis, and whether or not the assignment of the effective date of 2000 should be set earlier than that 2000 date, all in the same appeal. The other consideration, Your Honor,
would not the result of that, the practical result of that, mean that he would not get payment for his 100% until whenever the case was finally heard here, assuming that...
Well, that would be true, but he's not getting that now, Your Honor. He's not getting 100% from 1998 to 2000.
No, but he's getting his extra scheduler rating, but you would have them adjudicate everything together, so that would mean, I take it, not deciding this TDIU.
Oh, no. That decision was made and was made favorably during the appeal process. That's not different than any other incremental change in the initial rating assigned. What I'm talking about would have to be deferred would be a deferral by the board from a consideration of the VA's final decision on the initial rating assigned. And that final decision has not been subject to review by the board, and that record is not closed until such time as the board takes that up. That record is theoretically open right now. That record was closed as of the date of this board decision when they made that board decision, and he cannot submit any additional evidence on the question of unemployability on an extra scheduler basis based upon that final decision.
Wait a minute. He can't submit any additional information about his unemployability?
No, Your Honor, because...
Because he already has it.
Because he already has it.
So what...
Well, and the question...
But he can submit any evidence he wants to in order to enhance the scheduler rating.
In order to enhance the scheduler rating. But the question is whether these are inextricably intertwined issues. And here we're really dealing with three issues, and it's terribly important to remember that there's
issues. I think that as I read the case law, it doesn't talk about inextricably intertwined issues. It talks about inextricably intertwined claims.
That's correct.
Now, you just said we have one claim here. So I think the inextricably intertwined, based upon your view of these claims, is not an issue here, but that takes us into whether or not whether or not we have jurisdiction and questions like that. You would say those questions, we don't even have to concern ourselves with those because we only have one claim.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I do think that it is important for this court to articulate a rule of law that inextricably intertwined applies both to issues and to claims. And the reason that it has to apply to issues is the very reason that this case is in front of the court and why there is the confusion about what the appropriate disposition of this case is, because we have an intervening premature board decision on a downstream issue which should have never been addressed by the board until the entire claim, all issues, were addressed in the first instance.
All the board decided with regard to, as you refer the downstream issue, and you're talking about the downstream issue of effectiveness, correct? All the board decided was the 100%, he's entitled 100% on an extra scheduler basis as of this particular date.
Actually, I'm also talking about a downstream issue in relationship to extra scheduler rating. Because in this case, what we have...
Which the board has not yet decided.
Which correct? The board has not yet decided. But
so how does it assign? I'm still having a very difficult time, and I'm sorry that I'm keep going over this, but I have a hard time finding out or deciding or understanding why the veteran is prejudiced here in this case, because he still has the opportunity to present all the evidence he wants. He still has all of his appellate rights, before him.
It goes directly to the citation that this court relied on in Roebuck.
Okay, so you're just saying it's a Roebuck case, and because it's all one claim,
and that what should be avoided here, what should be prevented, what should be reinforced by this court is the rule of finality that you avoid or preclude repetitive and belated adjudication. The prejudice to him is that he has additional adjudications on issues that he should not have to adjudicate until there is a final decision on all issues involved in his claim by the board. And that was not done in the first board decision, and it should have been done in the first board decision. And all three issues, the issue of initial rating on a scheduler basis between 70% and 100, the right to an extra scheduler rating between 1998 and 100, and the question of whether the effective date was correctly assigned in 2000 or it should have reverted back to 1998 under 3.156B. Part of the complaint by the VA in their briefs is that we abandon our merits argument. Well, we abandon our merits argument based upon the theory that is articulated by this court in Roebuck. You deal with it all at one time.
Okay, so I mean, to try to sum it up so I can get it in one little sentence here. what you're saying is we got one claim, Roebuck controls, and therefore the board's decision here was
a nullity.
Well, I'm trying to think. Roebuck was sort of the opposite
situation. It's a flip side.
Roebuck
absolutely
was a jurisdictional case, and it was the opposite situation.
That's right. And
we didn't say in Roebuck that they couldn't decide the issue.
No.
What we said is that an individual still can continue his appeal. We didn't say the Secretary couldn't divide things up.
Right. And one of the rhetorical questions implicit in Roebuck was what would have happened had he appealed the first decision? And that's what happened here. Mr. Rice appealed the first decision, and the appropriate remedy is vacature of the board's decision and a direction to the board that under the rule of finality that they deal with all issues in a claim in a single board decision. And when, as here, there are multiple issues with appeals that have been perfected, and the board gets one issue and there's still an issue out there, then you defer consideration of the issue that is perfected until the remaining issue or issues have been perfected and you deal with it all at once in one board decision.
Yeah, I can see it makes sense if the adjudication of the matter, in this case, the TDIU element, would have an impact on the first claim. But I don't see it as having any practical impact here on the first claim.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that that's hopelessly...
Well, you're saying as a practical matter because they've decided they won't look at the evidence again.
No. I'm saying that because they have closed the door with a final, presumptively final decision on the effective date of the question of IU, then he is effectively prevented from that point to submit additional evidence on the question of effective date. Let's assume that the VA is correct.
No, he's not, because he still has, what he's saying is, look, I qualify, the only issue extant here is whether or not he qualifies for a higher than a 70% rating on a scheduler basis. That's the sole issue that's left in this case.
I disagree, Your Honor. That's why I've tried to reinforce that the three issues remain pending on an initial rating assigned, on a scheduler basis, on an extra scheduler basis, and as to the effective date which has been assigned as part of the initial rating assigned, which differs from the way in which this was treated by this board decision as though it were a new claim. And then it becomes a factually ascertainable in the 1 year before, and you're limited to the 1 year look back. There's more than 1 year at stake here. And so it is fundamentally different the issues that are presented in the appeal of the final board decision, which is the subject matter of this appeal, as opposed to the one that should have been made on all three of those issues. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Tierney.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Brian Tierney representing Police Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And again, with me at council table is Brian Rebel. The question before the Court this morning is, do the Federal Circuit opinions in Halpern and Hudson impliedly overrule this Court's decision in Harris and require remand rather than dismissal without prejudice when an issue is found to be inextricably intertwined based on judicial economy? The Secretary would argue that these cases do not impliedly overrule Harris, and in the present case, the proper remedy is dismissal of appellant's present appeal without prejudice. The Secretary asserted in his brief that these issues were not inextricably intertwined and would continue to assert that they are not inextricably intertwined. To the extent that they are inextricably intertwined, it would appear that this finding was based purely upon judicial economy.
Counsel, are there two claims here or one claim?
Your Honor, I would say that there are, in fact, two claims. There's one claim for a total disability rating based on individual unemployability, and also the scheduler rating claim. This court is generally held in Ray Leventhal and Roberson that there are two claims. Now, while the appellant presented a claim for service connection and was granted eventually a 70% rating, during the course of that claim, he asserted unemployability, and at that point, the claim based on TDIU was presented to the VA. Under Roberson, it was not necessary, you know, it could be found to be an informal claim based upon evidence presented at the time of a claim for service connection, but is not necessarily so.
How do you address appellant's argument that there's only one claim here with inextricably intertwined issues?
I would disagree with appellant, Your Honor, and argue that there are two claims, and while they may be inextricably intertwined based on considerations of judicial economy, they can be separately adjudicated by the VA and the board and ultimately this court, similar to the case of Colion, where in a very similar situation, the court was able to reach the merits of the TDIU claim and at the same time remand the scheduler or extra-scheduler rating in that case.
In your subsequent supplemental brief, you've taken a position that it's not the board decision that was premature, but the appellant's appeal is premature.
Correct.
Now, based on what you just said, I gather that this is an alternative argument, that you're not walking away from your original argument.
Correct, Your Honor. To the extent that these the two claims are inextricably intertwined, and I think the board's analysis of the issue was a reasonable one and based upon different considerations than this court has on judicial economy. I think if you take as a supposition that they were inextricably intertwined, then you then get to the position that it wasn't necessarily, the board decision was not necessarily premature. It was, in fact, the appeal that was premature.
Let's assume that, as the single judge found, that the claims or issues are inextricably intertwined in this case. And yet there's a board decision out there that says, I assume came with a notice of appellate rights. Am I correct? I
think. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. What's a veteran to do when he gets a decision that purports to be a final board decision, and yet he is faced potentially with the argument that was raised in Roebuck, and an argument that you've made in your subsequent brief, your supplemental brief, that any appeal exercised at that time would have been premature. How is a veteran supposed to square a notice of appellate rights with a belief on the part of the Secretary that he shouldn't do anything?
Well, I think in this case, it was correct for the appellant to appeal, and I think in a case where the court finds the claims inextricably intertwined, the appellant should appeal. The concept of inextricably intertwined is a way for this court to limit exercise of its power and in consideration of judicial economy.
And there are certainly some circumstances under which two issues are inextricably intertwined legally as well.
Correct. If there are, if the facts are dependent upon one another, or if the actual legal issues are dependent, if one is a predicate to a finding in the other, then the Secretary would argue that that would be a proper case for the court to vacate and remand, because those two claims belong together. In this instance, you had two claims that are completely separable. The TDIU claim is not dependent upon an increased scheduler rating below. The veteran has a 70% rating back to the date of service connection. So even if, you know, there's no pendant claim that would needs to be found, no, there's no factual or legal predicates that need to be decided prior to deciding the TDIU claim. Excuse me. As this court has found from beginning in Harris, both 7252 and 7266 read in concert require a final decision. So to the extent that this court finds that the board decision is not final, appellant's NOA is, the appeal is not ripe for the appellant to file an NOA.
Would that mean that this court has no jurisdiction, or would that just empower this court to decline to exercise its jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I think the court is declining to exercise the jurisdiction based upon reasons of judicial economy.
But doesn't Harris say that it's a jurisdictional matter? I mean, isn't that what Harris says? If we find they're inextricably intertwined, doesn't Harris say that we have no jurisdiction? That's what we should do?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you say now that it's a matter of judicial economy? That's one question. I have a follow-up question to that.
Well, I think it's a discretionary. It's discretionary with the court. In a similar situation, I noted Colleong earlier. You had the court address a TDIU and found that it wasn't inextricably intertwined and it could exercise its jurisdiction. I think the concept of inextricably intertwined raises issues of ripeness in addition to pure jurisdictional questions.
Tell me how it enhances judicial economy for us to choose dismissal over remand.
I'm not sure that it necessarily enhances judicial economy, Your Honor, but I think that the cases cited by the appellant, Hudson and Halpern, do not stand for the proposition that this court is precluded from dismissing the case.
No, but you see what I'm saying is that I don't think it would be, it seems to me it would be enhanced judicial economy if in one situation we had to actually consider the matter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
And in the other situation, we didn't consider the matter. But here, the only two alternatives that we're talking about, assuming it's inextricably intertwined, is the only difference is in one case we dismiss if we do take the view that Harris says that it's jurisdictional. And if you take the view it's not jurisdictional, then we remand because they're inextricably intertwined. In neither case does the court deal with the matter. So I do not see how judicial economy comes into play in our decision making one way or the other in this.
Your Honor, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I think it's within the discretion of the court to choose to do either. I think if you look at Hudson and Halpern, the basis for the Federal Circuit finding that a remand was more appropriate than a dismissal in those cases was that the court had actually exercised some of its power in those cases. I think that the Federal Circuit similarly in Gurley looked at the substance of what the court had done and said, despite the fact that we called it was termed a vacate and remand by the parties, in effect it was a dismissal. I think that there could be, and I would ask the court's indulgence that this wasn't mentioned in the briefs, but it would be possible for the court under Rule 5 to stay the case for judicial efficiency pending the outcome below. That would be a third option.
Mr. Tierney, why don't Hudson and Halpern preclude dismissal?
Well, Your Honor, I think they're completely different contexts. Halpern was the Federal Circuit looking at the court's decision on the proper jurisdiction of the board. So the Federal Circuit looked at the Court of Veterans Claims decision that the board didn't have jurisdiction to adjudicate an attorney's fee agreement case in the first instance. And the Federal Circuit said that that was sufficient exercise of jurisdiction to enable the EJA claim to be properly within the court's jurisdiction. Whereas in Hudson, the board had initially denied reopening of a service connection claim. The court found that there had been a NOD with the earlier rating decision, therefore that rating decision was not final. So the board's denial of reopening was the wrong issue to be adjudicating. The court dismissed the board, vacated and dismissed the appeal, vacated the board decision, and found that and ordered the VA to adjudicate the issue of the rating decision on the merits of service connection. So when the court had actually gotten into the jurisdiction of the matter and had addressed the merits, it wasn't a case of the court finding that there was no jurisdiction over the matter. It was the court had determined that the appellate posture of the case removed it from the court's jurisdiction. So the Federal Circuit looked at what had actually gone on below rather than the mere formality, and said and found that because this court had actually exercised its jurisdiction, it was more properly a vacate and a remand. And that is the flip side of what happened in Gurley, where the court, the Federal Circuit, looked at, although this court had issued an order and a joint remand, that was termed a vacate and remand, it was, in effect, a dismissal.
So the answer to the question why they don't preclude dismissal is what exactly?
They just can't be read that widely. The Federal Circuit continues to dismiss claims that are inextricably intertwined. In Gurley, they looked at the remedy of this. You know, they didn't actually address the question, but the remedy of dismissal was noted approvingly by the Federal Circuit and wasn't noted to be no longer an option in inextricably intertwined claims.
Does the procedural context of those three decisions, Gurley, Halperin, and Hudson, all EJIA cases, make any difference in your analysis, i.e., the distinctions that you've been talking about are really one step removed from what the court was looking at in determining whether or not there was a jurisdictional hook that supported an EJIA application? Am I correct?
Correct, yeah.
Does that make a difference in your analysis?
Certainly makes the analysis more complicated, Your Honor. I think that it still makes the analysis valid. I don't think that Halperin and Hudson can be read as expansively as the appellant wants this court to read them.
I want to make sure I understand. I know you've made alternative arguments, and
correct,
I just
right.
want to make sure I understand the sort of the hierarchy of those arguments. As I understand it, your first argument would be that that a claim for temporary or total disability based on individual unemployability and a claim for a scheduler rating based on the same underlying disability are two separate claims, and therefore they can be separately adjudicated.
Correctly. Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And your second argument, if we do not accept that argument, would be that we should find these inextricably intertwined or not?
It's within the court's discretion to find them inextricably intertwined.
If so, then we have two options. One is dismissal under Harris.
Correct.
And two would be you're offering us another option to stay our decision pending some sort of adjudication below.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, because you say it's within our discretion, I guess you're saying what is the... you mean it's within our discretion to determine if it's inextricably intertwined, or is that where our discretion lies, or is our discretion lie when once we find it's inextricably intertwined, what we must do?
Well, I think the considerations of the concept of inextricably intertwined based on judicial economy is a discretionary finding by the court. Otherwise, the holding in Colleon wouldn't necessarily make sense. In substantially similar circumstances, the court was able to issue a decision on the merits of the TDIU claim. If it's not within the discretion of the court, then the Colleon decision would not make sense.
Well, it seems to me that what you're saying is that obviously we have the responsibility to determine whether something's inextricably intertwined, I think in all cases. I mean, that regardless.
Correct, yeah.
But it seems to me what you're saying is, now, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that what you're saying is once we make that determination, if we say it is inextricably intertwined, then we have discretion either to dismiss or to remand.
Well, I think in this case where there is no pendent issue that needs to be decided, dismissal would be appropriate. In a case where it's inextricably intertwined based on a factual or a legal matter that is pendent or needs to be decided predicate to the board decision,
then a vacate and remand would be more appropriate.
But isn't that a determination? Isn't that what you just described? Isn't that the process of making a determination of whether claims or issues, take your pick, is inextricably intertwined? I mean,
I don't think that. I think you're, once you've found it inextricably intertwined, there's sort of a range of reasons why it's inextricably intertwined.
So are you saying then that,
I think in this,
you could make a finding that it's inextricably intertwined, but you might determine that in some cases that results in a determination that the board decision was not final, and in other cases, because of a judicial economy, we are simply not going to exercise our jurisdiction? Is that what you're saying?
To some extent, Your Honor, yes. When you've got a in this particular case where you've got an issue of TDIU that is not dependent on the scheduler rating that's been remanded back to the board, the issues of fact and law were ready to be determined by the board and could be determined by this court.
So you're saying that there is a final board decision in this instance?
Correct, Your Honor.
And if the issues are dependent on each other, then you would say that the board decision would not be final, as the court said in Harris? It's not a trick question.
I think I'm misunderstanding.
You just go ahead and answer it.
No, I think I'm misunderstanding. I think I'm misunderstanding the question.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, can you have, in your analysis with regard to inextricably intertwined issues, two possibilities, one of which leads to a conclusion that the board decision was not final, as the court in Harris said, and another possibility that because you're basing the inextricably intertwined analysis solely on issues of judicial economy, that you may have a final board decision that you simply are not going to review? Is that?
That follows logically, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, is that what you're trying to say? I'm just, you know, I'm trying to understand your argument here.
Well, I think what I'm trying to say is in a case such as this where you have a TDIU claim with no pendent issue out there that needs to be determined, a dismissal is more appropriate because it's non-final. If there were a pendent claim out there, in many TDIU appeals, there's a service connection claim that still needs to be adjudicated, or there's a rating claim that would impact the TDIU. In those types of appeals, it makes more sense because there's further action that needs to be taken by the board a vacate and a remand.
Let's say in this case his final rating for PTSD and the scheduler basis have been 40%.
Correct, John.
In that case, that would they would be strictly intertwined because if he got 70%, then he would meet the low threshold and under the regulation.
Clearly. So if there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, where the Court in Harris was incorrect was in its conclusion that there was not a final decision. There was a final decision because the board made and published a final decision, and as Judge Mormon pointed out to the government, issued a notice of appellate rights. That's precisely what happened here. The Federal Circuit in Halperin and Hudson recognized that when the board makes such a final decision, then that final decision implicates this court's jurisdiction under 7252 and gives the appellant the right under 7266 to have review of that decision. The question in this case, however, is the definition of finality of board's decisions and whether they should have made a final board decision. In this case, they should not have made a final board decision because there is only one claim. The position of the government in this case is patently absurd to suggest that there are two claims. They ask this court to adopt the myth, the fiction, that somehow there is a separate, freestanding TDIU claim. And because it can be adjudicated separately, that this gives the VA a free pass not to process Mr. Rice's appeal of the initial rating assigned. And that's precisely what happened here. And as a consequence, he ends up getting a premature final decision on the question of effective date of IU without ever having even received a statement of case as required under 7105. So his appeal has been unreasonably delayed and unlawfully withheld until such time as the board finally intervenes and makes a partially correct decision in sending the matter back for the issuance of an SOC. The government has confused the notion of can be separately adjudicated with the question of finality. Of course, these issues can be, and in this case were, separately adjudicated. That has nothing to do with the question of whether or not this court has jurisdiction in this case. This court has jurisdiction in this case under 7252, under 7266, under the Federal Circuit's decisions in Halpern and in Hudson, and most recently, this court's own decision in Robach, recognizing that there are times in which the board makes decisions that they identify as final, that they give notice to the appellant are final, and in fact, they are not final. And that creates a fundamental problem for the appellant.
So you say we have jurisdiction in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what should we do?
You should vacate the board's decision. You should remand with instructions to the board to defer consideration of the matter of the effective date of the award of a total rating based on unemployability until such time as they consider the initial rating to be assigned on both a scheduler basis and on an extra scheduler basis. And at that time, they should issue a final decision addressing any or all of those issues as is required.
And you would have the board do that with regard to any claim for benefits that it receives?
Yes, Your Honor. Because if they don't, then they end up violating the rule of finality, because they end up creating this morass that the government has now offered up as to the various scenarios in which this court should create a checklist to decide whether or not we should have belated and repeated adjudications of the same claim.
Well, what if a veteran on the same claim for benefits files a claim for five different disabilities?
Hmm?
And several of them require referral to medical experts in different disciplines, etc. Are you suggesting that the board should not decide any of those until it has all of them before it?
Well, those are certainly not the facts in this case,
Your
Honor.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to think.
But assuming
you know, where
such
are we
an extreme
headed?
Hypothetical, I would have to say that under the way that I understand the rule of finality out of Bingham, Roebuck, and Cook, that yes, that is precisely what needs to take place. Because there is the potential that if the board were to decide one of those claims differently on appeal, that would affect the disposition of those other claims.
But that's not the situation that we have here.
No, it's certainly not the situation we have here, which is why this court needs to address the fact that, as Judge Hagel pointed out, up to this point, this court has only dealt with the notion of inextricably intertwined claims. This case presents the notion of inextricably intertwined issues, which is really at the heart of what this court carved out in Dingus when it talked about the five elements of the claim and needing to be able to address all of those elements and in the same adjudication. Now, in obviously Dingus, it was the same notice. In this case, it involves the same adjudication of the appeal. Mr. Rice's appeal commenced with the filing of his NOD. What he ended up was getting a board decision on effective date of TDIU and effectively deprived of the benefit of his appeal of the initial rating assigned and still hasn't gotten a final board decision on that. And as a consequence, when they dealt with the downstream issue of IU and effective date for IU, there was no Fenderson analysis because they treated it incorrectly as a separate claim. It is not a separate claim. It is part and parcel of the only claim that Mr. Rice has had pending, which is...
What's the difference between the practical difference between dismissal and remand?
Well, I believe that there are two. First, if this court dismisses, the practical difference is that it rewards the board for violating the rule of finality. It rewards the board for having decided a downstream issue prematurely. And it rewards the board for forcing the veteran to take the appeal to this court in order to get a dismissal, which implicitly vacates the board decision, but does not explicitly vacate that board decision. The second problem is that you don't end up addressing the error made, and there is no instruction. So what happens is that the board continues to repeat the same problems, the same mistakes that they have made in adjudicating these downstream issues when there are upstream issues that should have been deferred to and gotten one single board decision on the appeal initiated by the veteran.
Mr. Carpenter, yes. Let's assume for a moment that Harris incorrectly concluded there was no jurisdiction. Okay. Yet we have Harris as precedent.
Yes.
Your remedy is to vacate and remand.
Correct.
Harris says dismiss, no jurisdiction. What options does this court have? Actually, let me divide that. What options does this panel have, and what options does the full court have?
And that's why I framed my motion for reconsideration that Harris was implicitly overruled by the Federal Circuit's decision. If this court agrees that Harris was implicitly overruled by the Federal Circuit's decisions in Halpern and Hudson on the question of jurisdiction and on the question of remedy, then clearly I believe this panel, relying upon the Federal Circuit's decision, can make a determination that the Federal Circuit decisions have implicitly overruled that jurisdictional determination made in Harris. Alternatively, this panel could take the approach to refer the matter to the full court to decide whether or not the full court needs to take up en banc whether or not the rule created in Harris is still a viable rule and an appropriate remedy. I don't believe I have anything else to offer unless there's any further questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Hey, thank you very much. Case is submitted.
All right.
The court will read the bar.
Court is adjourned until further order.